Now, our presentation today is on Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the Woman's Bible. Some of you have been here a while know I have a series. I sometimes call it Famous UU Women We've Never Heard Of. I have some of them on my name tag if you want to ask me about them later. Who knew that we had a black Unitarian suffragist or a woman in Australia who was a universalist who worked for voting reform over 100 years ago? So sometimes the problem is finding enough information. In this case, The problem is there's too much information. There are multiple biographies of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. There also, she wrote her own memoirs. She and Susan B. Anthony wrote a history of their work with women's suffrage. There's even a Ken Burns documentary. I focused on a biography by a woman named Laurie D. Ginsburg called Elizabeth Cady Stanton, An American Life, which I can share with you afterwards. The author says Stanton is the historical figure that she has fought with the most over the years. Stanton was brilliant, hardworking, far-seeing, and deeply influential. She was also insensitive to the lives of many who never had her advantages. And she was willing, along with others, to use racism and xenophobia to advance the causes she fought for. So I wanted to put that out there in the beginning, that many of our icons also had flaws. I'm just going to give a brief background of Stanton's life and work and then talk about her radical reinterpretation of the Bible. Elizabeth was born in 1815 in Johnstown, New York, to a well-off family. Her father was a landowner, lawyer, legislator, and judge. Her parents were traditional and strict in their upbringing, and the church backed them up. The young Elizabeth said, quote, "Everything we like to do is a sin, and everything we dislike is commanded by God or someone on earth." Her most vivid memory of childhood was at the death of her brother, the only surviving boy in the family. When a distraught 11-year-old Elizabeth turned to her father for comfort, he sighed, "Oh, daughter, I wish you were a boy." The girl decided the chief thing to be done in order to equal boys was to be learned and courageous. At school, she led in both mathematics and foot races. Now, we usually see her older picture as you see in the order of service here, but apparently she was quite an athlete in her youth. Although there was no college education available for girls, her family did send her to a female seminary attended by daughters of important politicians and businessmen. With her family background, Elizabeth never had to worry about supporting herself or rushing into marriage. When she was 24, she met Henry Stanton, 10 years her senior. He was an extraordinary speaker and organizer in the abolitionist movement. Elizabeth always continued to use her maiden name along with her husband's last name. That's why we have Elizabeth Cady Stanton. After some years in Boston, they moved to Seneca Falls, New York. They had 7 children in 17 years. They were spaced out by what Elizabeth called, quote, voluntary motherhood. She deliberately gave her children a different childhood from her own with lots of fresh air, games, and education for both boys and girls. Like several other prominent abolitionists, Elizabeth and Henry attended the World Anti-Slavery Convention in London in 1840. They were shocked to find that women were forbidden from speaking and forced to sit behind a curtain. Here Elizabeth met Lucretia Mott, who had the same type of reaction. Several years later, those two were the central organizers of the famous Seneca Falls Convention, which is counted as the launch of the suffragist movement. 300 people heard the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments written by Elizabeth and based on the Declaration of Independence. This momentous event was met with hostility and ridicule in much of the press and the public. Opinion writers bemoaned that the movement would foster irreligion, divorce, and, gasp, independence. The act of a woman speaking in public on any topic was still controversial, even for women who spoke on abolition, for instance. Stanton became a woman on a mission, devoting herself to her cause, speaking and writing with facts, irony, and sarcasm. Once Elizabeth connected with Susan B. Anthony, they became the acknowledged leaders and face of the movement. As such, they were closely scrutinized. They adopted for a while the bloomer costume. It was a shorter dress over wide pantaloons, which allowed for freedom of movement and freedom from corsets. But they found that, just as today, reporters focused so much on their clothing that it took away from their message. They wanted to stand out, as in the children's story, right? But that was distracting. So they reverted to standard dress. Like many other abolitionists and suffragists, Stanton also supported temperance. When Susan B. Anthony was forbidden from speaking at the state temperance convention because she was a woman, she and Stanton founded the Women's State Temperance Society. In 1863, during the Civil War, Stanton and Anthony organized the Women's Loyal National League to campaign for an amendment ending slavery. They had hoped that the campaign would establish rights for all citizens, regardless of race or gender. Of course, at the end of the war, when the 14th Amendment was passed, it stated male citizens. But there was no restriction on who could run for Congress. So in 1866, Elizabeth Cady Stanton did so. She ran as an independent and received only 24 votes. But her story was carried in newspapers around the country. During debate on the 15th Amendment, which forbade discrimination in voting by race, color, or previous condition of servitude, a split occurred in the suffragist movement. Some, including Lucy Stone, agreed that the fate of the black man in the South was a literal matter of life and death. They felt that his franchise should be assured, with women's voting to come later. Others, including Stanton and Anthony, felt betrayed and adopted some questionable tactics to influence the public. Stanton wrote, "American women of wealth, education, virtue, and refinement, if you do not wish the lower orders of Chinese, Africans, Germans, and Irish, with their low ideas of womanhood, to make laws for you and your daughters, demand that women too shall be represented in government." So how could you have all these inappropriate people voting and not give it to nice white ladies? In another article, Stanton objected to laws being made for women by, quote, "Patrick and Sambo and Hans and Young Tongue, who do not know the difference between a monarchy and a republic." Stanton and Anthony also allied themselves with George Train. He was a flamboyant businessman with a knack for media coverage. He ran for president and backed women's suffrage, but he expressed outright racism and said he really wanted to be a dictator. In 1868, Anthony and Stanton began publishing a weekly newspaper, The Revolution, whose motto was, "Men, their rights and nothing more, women, their rights and nothing less." Their initial funding came from George Train, but he took off for England, where he was jailed for supporting Irish independence, leaving the women to pay off substantial debts. The conflict over the amendments led to the founding of two separate women's groups, the National Women's Suffrage Association, led by Stanton and Anthony, and the American Women's Suffrage Association, led by Lucy Stone and Julia Ward Howe. Ironically, Elizabeth disliked conventions and meetings. Her strength was in thinking and writing. She often skipped the conventions, having Susan B. Anthony represent her views. In 1876, Aunt Susan, as the family called Anthony, moved into the Stanton house so that the two could work on their history of the women's suffrage movement. They encouraged Lucy Stone, head of the rival organization, to participate, but she refused. Therefore, the history concentrates on the work of its two authors. And there were other people who were left out, women who worked in the Midwest, women who had worked largely in Europe. So they wrote about their own work mostly. From 1869 to 1879, Elizabeth was a regular speaker on a lyceum circuit. This involved travel by train, carriage, and even sleigh. Her most popular lecture, Our Girls, urged young women to be independent and to seek self-fulfillment. Other popular lectures were Our Boys, Co-Education, Marriage and Divorce, and The Subjugation of Women. On Sundays, she would often speak on famous women in the Bible, and the Bible and women's rights. For these speeches, Stanton earned a very good income, equivalent to over $100,000 in today's measure. Throughout her life, Elizabeth had certain blind spots. She supported a requirement that only educated citizens should vote. She once wrote, "What would this continent have been if left to the Indians? Would they ever have attained our present civilization?" And once she stated, "How much further advanced the Chinese would have developed had Anglo-Saxon blood been infused there?" So some of these were ideas of the time. This was developing into an era where people felt that science should be applied to human breeding just like it was to animals, which led to eugenics. This was a bit later, but the idea of different races was still in the public eye. In the 1890s, Stanton took on the ambitious project of the Woman's Bible, which I'll go into in a moment. She also wrote an autobiography entitled 80 Years and More. When she died in 1902, at the age of 86, she had so many articles already written that her work continued to appear in newspapers for weeks. Well, let's look at the Woman's Bible, a shocking and even heretical statement for the era, or any era. Stanton assembled a group of female scholars, some of whom knew Hebrew and Greek. They reviewed passages in the Bible that referred to women. In the introduction, Stanton states, "I do not believe that any man ever saw or talked with God. I do not believe that God inspired the Mosaic Code or told the historians what they say he did about woman. For all the religions on the face of the earth degrade her. And so long as woman accepts the position that they assign her, her emancipation is impossible." Elizabeth had long before rejected the religious beliefs of her childhood. She regularly attended programs by Unitarian minister Theodore Parker. She also rejected the idea of America as a Christian nation. Some of the abolitionists and temperance advocates claimed that teaching Christian ethics in school would improve society. But at the convention establishing the National American Woman Suffrage Association, Elizabeth declared, "The association is opposed to all union of church and state and pledges itself to maintain the secular nature of government." The Woman's Bible goes through the books in order, so starts out with Genesis. The first volume covers parts of the Old Testament. In the story of the fall, Stanton notes that woman isn't tempted by beauty, riches, or power, but by knowledge. When the sin is discovered, Adam's reaction is to whine that it's all his woman's fault and blame his wife. When we get to the flood, the writers of this version question how the animals could have assembled from the various climates they lived in and judges the quality of life on the ark. The paucity of light and air in this vessel shows that woman had no part of its architecture. That is, women would have designed it with more windows and more practicality. Throughout the Old Testament, Stanton finds examples of women who have courage and judgment. She claims that if Miriam had led the Israelites rather than Moses, they would have arrived in the Promised Land in 40 days instead of 40 years. Maybe he didn't want to ask for directions. Overall, she proclaims of the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch is a long, painful record of war, corruption, rapine, and lust. Here's a comment by Elizabeth on rites and traditions of the Old Testament. "The people have always been deluded with the idea that what they gave to the church and the priesthood was given unto the Lord, as if the maker of the universe needed anything at our hands. How incongruous the idea of an infinite being who made all the planets and the inhabitants thereof, commanding his creatures to kill and burn animals for offerings to him. It is truly pitiful to see the deceptions that have been played upon people in the name of religion." Well, how do you think this publication was received in Victorian America? Actually, it was a bestseller with 7 printings in 6 months. But it was widely attacked, including by leaders of the suffrage movement who felt it would hurt their cause. In the preface to part 2, Stanton addresses this. "A clergyman said it is the work of women and the devil. This is a grave mistake. His Satanic Majesty was not invited to join the revising committee, which consists of women alone. Moreover, he has been so busy of late years attending synods, general assemblies, and conferences to prevent the recognition of women delegates that he has no time to study the language of higher criticism. In the second volume, the scholars completed their review of the Old Testament, restoring the reputations of strong women like Delilah and Jezebel. And they also dismissed the, quote, far-fetched theory that the Song of Solomon is an allegory about Christ's love for the church. A third volume covers the New Testament, starting with the birth of Jesus. Stanton wrote, "Why the founders of the Christian religion did not improvise an earthly father as well as an earthly mother does not clearly appear. The biblical mysteries in the position of Joseph are unsatisfactory. They are a great strain on the credulity of the ordinary mind." She also said, "I think the doctrine of the virgin birth as something higher, sweeter, nobler than ordinary motherhood is a slur on all the natural motherhood of the world. And in general, this thought of Jesus as the second person of an inconceivable Trinity, this conception is part of a scheme of the universe which represents humanity as ruined and lost and hopeless, God as unjust, and man as looking only to a fearful judgment in the ages that are to be. I believe that thousands of people have lived since the time of Jesus as good, as tender, as loving, as true, as faithful as he." Later she comments, "As for the passages now found in the New Testament epistles of Paul concerning women's non-equality with men and their duty of subjection, there is no room to doubt that they are barefaced forgeries interpolated by unscrupulous bishops." So these are some of the quotations about how women should be silent and obey their husbands. This volume concludes, "The real difficulty in woman's case is that the whole foundation of the Christian religion rests on her temptation and man's fall, thus the necessity of a redeemer. If, however, we accept that the story of the fall is a myth, we can exonerate the snake, emancipate the woman, and reconstruct a more rational religion for the 19th century." Although Stanton and her collaborators expected condemnation from the church and society in general, they were disturbed that the women's suffrage movement also rejected this book. And this reminded me, in a way, of the women's movement in the 1970s that did not want lesbians to be prominent because it would make their movement look bad. At the 1896 convention of Stanton's North American Women's Suffrage Association, a young leader, Rachel Foster Avery, attacked the book and introduced a resolution to formally distance their organization from Stanton's book. Of course, Elizabeth, as usual, wasn't there, but Susan B. Anthony spoke up forcefully against the move. However, it passed by a vote of 53-41. This introduced a rift between Stanton and the younger generation of leaders that never healed. So this was just a brief introduction to this subject. Although I knew about Stanton from her suffrage work, as most of us do, I think her leadership in this norm-breaking women's Bible deserves to be more recognized. And well, let me grab these. So this was a very readable biography. And the Woman's Bible is available here with there is a small foreword, but most of this is the original. There were a number of authors, but Elizabeth Cady Stanton was the leader and wrote most of the passages that I quoted. So it's just it was something that I really was not aware of. We're aware that Thomas Jefferson rewrote the Bible to make it more reasonable. But this was a new attempt, and some of her comments are so delightfully snarky that I really enjoyed them.